May it please the court. My name is Michael Devaney. I'm here today representing the estate of John King. Lisa King, the widow of John King, is requesting that this court vacate a judgment and finding of no liability following a jury trial, a bifurcated jury trial, for three reasons. Your Honor, this case is about the failure of the trial court to apply the correct legal standard and to follow the explicit decisions of this court in the law of the case.
Yeah, and the defense cites a lot of waiver cases, but as I understand, the bottom line of your position is this case is different because the district court knew the correct law at the time, and he could have done something about it.
Thank you, Your Honor. That is exactly our position, and the case that best illustrates that of all the cases laid out is Lopez versus Chicago, because in that case, the party stipulated at the trial that the Fourth Amendment governed the claim, but the judge decided he was going to apply on he took the case from the jury and decided to analyze the case under deliberate indifference standard, which is what happened here. We were required to prove deliberate indifference as opposed to objective reasonableness. So we don't believe there is prejudice on these facts. The trial court was allowed to address the issue before trial.
Go ahead.
Well, but the defendants have been preparing their defense all along under the deliberate indifference standard, so they were prejudiced by this very late change.
Not actually prejudiced, Your Honor, for two reasons. One, they're part of the problem. In response to our complaint, they said they didn't know if there'd ever been a probable cause hearing in this case, and they never fessed up that there was. In fact, at the trial, they were still, or at pretrial conference, they were still attempting to claim there might have been. So that fact was unclear. But to your point, there is no actual prejudice, Judge, because of what they argued. The theory of their case was professional judgment. Now, they would have this court believe that the theory of their case was, at page 26 in their brief, we wouldn't be able to now argue, yes, this nurse was negligent and actually grossly negligent. But our briefs illustrate that that was not the theory of their case. The theory of their case was that she exercised a reasonable professional judgment, and that is best illustrated by their expert on nursing, who testified just exactly to that. Their testimony, they didn't have to retool anything. That testimony would have fit just as well into an objective reasonableness standard.
Okay, I understand that, but as Judge Williams knows and Judge Bauer knows, when you spend years preparing a case for trial from plaintiff's perspective, defendant's perspective, and the court's perspective, and that's kind of like a big long ship, and you're right on the cusp of trial when your November 27th letter comes out, and you'd been all the way up to our court arguing under deliberate indifference, so through the whole discovery, motions to dismiss, summary judgment process, appeal, and then right on the brink of trial, you're changing that, you're trying to turn that ship. It's kind of tough to do. And I don't see any reason, I understand the cases, I don't see any reason why it didn't come until November 27th of 2012.
No, that's the question I feared answering most.
And the reason, then related to that, okay, you've come to the realization, guys, this is an objective reasonableness case. Let's put the trial off for 6 months or maybe even a year. It wasn't filed until 3 years after the death. What would the harm have been from delay, short delay, longer delay? I don't know.
We would have been more than happy to put the trial off.
Did you suggest that?
Yes. Yes.
Not in your letter, you didn't.
No, not to the defense counsel. This was in the context of how this would be resolved.
In the pretrial conference with the judge?
Yes.
And the judge wasn't willing to move the trial?
The judge made it clearly uncertain there was no way this case was going to be continued.
I've asked you a whole bunch of questions balled up in one, but you can respond.
I would like to address the fear I had about being asked about why didn't you do this sooner. And the way I would explain it is, these cases have evolved as they relate to arrestees. And that word just came out to describe the person who's taken into custody before they've had a probable cause hearing in Curry v. Chabra, which is just a 2013 case. And Judge Wood, when she wrote the decision, said, for the purpose of clarity, I think she clearly established it then that there is this distinction, and the parties have argued throughout these cases some uncertainty about what applies. It appeared in the old cases that all of the arrestee situations where the Fourth Amendment might have applied to detectives, to lockup keepers, but not to medical personnel. But in 2011, shortly before this court decided King, that's when the light bulb or the bulb went on, in my mind, because of the
So before our appeal in King, before our decision in King?
No, this was what well, was before your decision in King, but after oral arguments, while it was pending, the case of Ortiz versus Chicago came out. And in Ortiz, Judge Wood said that an arrestee cannot be treated like a hot potato and passed on from one handler to the other. Everyone who deals with a person with medical complaint must be treated reasonably. They must be addressed reasonably. And it was really those two cases that clarified everything. Believe me, Judge Tinder, if we knew that that standard applied earlier, certainly we would have brought it. I would submit that the law was unclear on this distinction that is now clear.
Now, this motion to continue the trial, was this done orally or was this a written motion?
We didn't make a motion to continue the trial. What we did, Your Honor, was suggest that a continuance was better than having to split the difference.
Now, that's not in your response to the motion in limine that I can find.
No, Your Honor.
This was done in a discussion?
This was in a phone conference.
Phone conference?
I believe it was, if my memory serves me right.
Or was it a phone conference with a court reporter present at the judge's chambers?
I'm sorry, it would have been the final pretrial at the courthouse.
If I asked defense counsel, did plaintiff's counsel resist continuing the trial, their answer would be no, the plaintiff's counsel did not resist continuing the trial.
That would be what I would believe, Your Honor, and that would be the case. The defense did not want a continuance, or they suggested we were going to have a long continuance. We have to have all our experts consider this deliberate indifference standard versus the other, which turned out not to be true, because as I've said, they used reasonableness as the standard at the trial. And if I might, Judge, I will bear the fault of not recognizing this as soon as possible, and that will sting us. But it shouldn't control the decision of this court. The decision of this court really should turn on the fact that the court had a chance to address it and the issue of whether a trial court can ever
It's just hard for me to appreciate that if you'd taken the position in front of the trial judge, we just can't go to trial under this deliberate indifference standard. It's the wrong standard. Please give us more time. The judge recognized that the Fourth Amendment controlled. Please, Judge, give us more time so that we can try this case under the right standard. If you'd gone at it that way, it's hard for me to imagine the judge would have resisted that.
But the judge, and I can't quote you in the record where it was said, but I believe everyone would agree, this judge made it clear this case was not being continued. He felt it was way too old at the time, and that's why we proceeded as
we
did.
And it had been all the way up and back.
It had been.
There was a lot of time. A lot of judicial resources had been devoted to this.
Agreed, Your Honor, but I would come back to the principle of can a court who recognizes and allows a case to proceed under a Fourth Amendment claim separate the constitutional amendment from its governing standard? And I would submit that that can't be done. If the judge had said, this is not a Fourth Amendment case, you filed it as a 14th Amendment case, and you're stuck with that, we probably wouldn't be here. But that's not what happened. He agreed, and he agreed with some fight from the defense that there had not been a probable cause determination and that this was a warrantless arrest case. And again, it is the evolution of these cases that really controlled our awareness of the standard and raising it as soon as we could and at a time when the trial court could address it. If I may, Judge, I would like to also address my second point, which would be the exclusion The exclusion of the contract
Well, one of the arguments that the defense makes is that there would be, had the court applied the correct standard, there would have been a difference between Kramer and the other individuals who were dismissed, and it was unfair that King could bring the Fourth Amendment claim, but not against Kramer, but not against the other individual defendants.
And that is procedurally correct, Your Honor, and we would not seek to raise a new claim against the dismissed defendants. We don't. And I think that's consistent with the court's decision in Williams, which is relied upon by the trial court and by the defendants. But Williams shouldn't govern, because Williams did not directly address a waiver. And the language of Williams suggests that the most important fact is, did you bring the issue to the attention of the trial court at a time it was capable of acting on it? What I would submit is there is not real prejudice here, that they have not shown real prejudice. Their prejudice arguments are weak, and undue prejudice requires some stronger showing.
Well, in that Williams case, it was never raised. The Fourth Amendment argument was never raised to the district court. Is that right?
That's correct. It was not. It was never raised and never argued on appeal. And the court, really, in that case, it was dicta, said, and by the way, it's worth noting that the Fourth Amendment would have governed this case, but it wasn't raised. And because summary judgment was granted, if this court had granted summary judgment or upheld the grant of summary judgment on our last appeal, we wouldn't be here on any of these. So procedural, I think we're on proper ground in asking that this court say that a trial court can't separate the legal standard from the amendment itself. That's consistent with case law, I believe.
And I see you're in your rebuttal time. I just wanted to make you aware
of
that. You
stop
can go
then.
Further, but
no.
You're eating into your
thank you, Judge.
Co-counsel's time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Sullivan?
May it please the court, I represent Sue Kramer, the nurse in this case, who was sued for deliberate indifference. In the initial complaint, in the amended complaint, in a second attempted amended complaint, throughout the discovery phase in the case.
Well, it's true, as you say, the pleading alleged deliberate indifference, but we don't require legal theories be pled, and one isn't necessarily bound by the description of legal theory. But if I understand the complaints that were filed, the complaint, amended complaint, and so forth, the allegation was that King was a pretrial detainee awaiting a probable cause hearing, that the lack of a probable cause hearing was a factual allegation, right?
Yes.
So wasn't that a clue that the Ortiz and these other cases would apply?
Well, Your Honor, I think the shoe would be on both feet with respect to that question. If, in fact, they knew that that was a significant fact, and if, in fact, the Williams decision was decided in 2007, which started this pattern that my colleague has referenced, Mr. Devaney, then, in fact, they knew at that point that they had a Fourth Amendment claim. My job as a trial lawyer, Judge, is to defend my client based upon the theory that I am facing. As the ship is coming towards Sue Kramer, my job is to deflect that however I best can based on the evidence, based on the expert testimony, based on the legal theory. And I did that for 2.5 years.
But your role isn't to encourage the judge to go to trial on a wrong legal standard.
I didn't encourage the judge to do that, Judge. And
well,
I must say...
Well, tell me how not.
I proceeded to trial. The judge's ruling was we're going to trial under the Fourth Amendment, but on a deliberate indifference standard. And Mr. Devaney did not oppose that strenuously. He filed no motions in opposition to that. My client had spent...
Was there a discussion of continuing the trial so that your experts could recalibrate?
No, Judge. There was not...
There was no discussion.
Based on my recollection, there was no discussion. There's certainly nothing on the record I've asked my associate, Mr. Freed, my colleague, Ms. Doyle, we're not recalling that conversation. It's certainly not in the record, or you would have it in front of you. The only recollection I have about Judge Connolly's reference to adjourning the trial was in response to my comment to him that I might need to bring a motion to address some evidence that was going to come in against La Crosse County, and he said, that would be an absurd motion, Mr. Sullivan, and I said, Judge, I don't like to file absurd motions, so I won't file it. That was the only discussion at the final pretrial about adjourning the trial so that people could have more time to address anything.
So let me ask you this. What if the parties have proceeded to summary judgment and use the standard beyond a reasonable doubt, which is clearly the wrong standard? Are you saying if the plaintiff didn't point that out until the final pretrial conference, the judge could not instruct the jury on the proper standard?
No, Judge, I'm
not. Or you'd say that he should just instruct the court on beyond a reasonable doubt? Because that's the problem I had. The judge knew this was the wrong standard and went to trial on it. And the judge, sua sponte, could have said additional time is needed. I mean, I also have a problem with your suggestion that, you know, you needed further discovery with the experts because the experts couldn't testify they couldn't make the ultimate determination. They didn't use the word deliberate indifference in their findings or anything, and they're prohibited from doing that. They could talk about the circumstances, reasonable care, and that kind of thing. So I know I've asked two questions, so could you address?
Yes, Judge. I think with respect to the first question, no, I'm not suggesting that if the case is proceeding to trial on a beyond a reasonable doubt standard that I, as an officer of the court, would not object to that and point it out, Judge, that's, you know, we need more time to get the correct mechanism in place here so that this case doesn't come back to us all.
Well, isn't that akin to what happened here?
No, it is not, Judge, because this is a very nuanced area of litigation, the deliberate indifference and objectively unreasonable.
But there's a whole reason, I think, in the law for that difference to exist, because you have pretrial. I mean, you have someone who hasn't even had a probable cause hearing.
Right.
To me, is different than those that have been through that process. I mean, that's what the point is, isn't it?
Right, Judge, but we get back to the...
How are you prejudiced? Is the, Judge Williams correctly points out this deliberate indifference, it's a mental state.
Right.
It is not the subject of your expert's testimony. Your expert's testimony, I think to a person, in looking back at the transcripts, testified about the standard of care that was provided, whether this was below the standard of care, which is going to be the same. One would think the standard of care for a pretrial detainee would be this, awaiting probable cause would be the very same as one who's had his probable cause.
Your Honor, if this were a negligence case, perhaps that's true. But this is a deliberate indifference case.
It's not.
Well, it was in the posture.
Reasonableness case. That's the problem.
In the posture
and
that I was faced with.
All the parties, it was known by the judge, that the standard, as we see it, is objective reasonableness. It's not a deliberate indifference case, yet you let it, and in fact, from my perspective, you forced it to go to trial under the wrong standard.
Your Honor, I forced it to a trial.
It appears you did.
I respectfully disagree, Judge. I followed Judge Connolly's directives. I didn't object to proceeding to trial after we had been preparing for 2.5 years at
you
tens of thousands of dollars.
To the jury being properly instructed under the standard of objective reasonableness.
I filed a motion in limine, Judge, because Mr. Devaney did not timely bring this before the court under the Seventh Circuit's precedent.
You insisted that the jury be instructed with the wrong legal standard.
Yes, Judge. Based on the Seventh Circuit.
That's error. That's harmful error. I don't see how you are prejudiced by the jury being instructed on the proper legal standard.
Judge, because
your witnesses are prejudiced, if that standard is something they, as medical practitioners, consider, they maybe need some time to think about it and then present their testimony.
Your Honor, the precedent in this circuit is
it's a death case.
I understand, Judge.
It's
as
a case
have,
that has been so important it came to our court once already.
Yes, Judge. And at that point in time, Mr. Devaney would have been barred from raising this Fourth Amendment issue because he hadn't brought it up on summary judgment.
Well, no. I mean, when the law is the law, And so, you know, I understand it would have meant a continuance, but to have the court instruct the jury on the wrong standard when everybody knew, I mean, I'm not even aware of a case like this. Are you? Do you have a case like this where the court was alerted before the before it went to the jury, essentially before trial, on the legal standard, and it was upheld in the Court of Appeals?
No,
when the
Judge,
wrong standard was
I
applied.
I can't point that.
Right, and there's a reason you can't, because that's a big problem. It's a big problem. Because what if we affirm this, then we're saying to a district court, if you are notified of this, but because of, you know, sort of considerations, it's been on the docket for so long, you know, there's been discovery, it's like a problem, then we would be encouraging the court to make decisions based on that rather than what the law is. I mean, I don't see how you get around it.
Judge, I think the converse of that is you will, if you find in favor of the appellant, you're encouraging that kind of delay tactic, perhaps, I would call it. I'm not calling it intentional or dilatory, but if a plaintiff or an appellant decides at the last minute that they are now going to go forward with a brand new issue, it poses all kinds of problems for a defense lawyer.
This is,
well,
yeah, but
we do have a provision in the rules that allow you to conform the pleadings to the evidence even after trial.
Absolutely.
This is not an unrecognized concept. Would you agree, Mr. Sullivan, that deliberate indifference is a higher standard than objective reasonableness?
Yes, Judge.
So the jury here considered the case under a higher standard than the law required?
The jury considered this case under the law that Judge Connolly read to them at the close of the case, based on his decisions.
Which was deliberate indifference.
Correct.
Which is a higher burden.
Indeed.
For the plaintiff than objective reasonableness.
Indeed.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Ms. Doyle.
I'm sure you're delighted to be coming up second.
Right. Yeah, you've got a hard road to hoe.
May it please the court. I represent La Crosse County and will address the two issues raised by King with respect to La Crosse County. As this court is aware, this case has been on appeal before, and it was remanded for trial, which it did proceed to trial. During the trial, the jury did hear evidence regarding La Crosse meetings with HPL regarding medical care, regarding La Crosse's oversight over the contract, and how La Crosse was being proactive with respect to the medical care provided to the inmates. During that trial, the plaintiff was given significant latitude in questioning witnesses with respect to the newspaper articles and the claims that medical care was not being properly given. And even with that information and that questioning, the jury found that there was not an official policy of denying inmates medication without appropriate physician oversight.
Let me ask you this. Did the contract provisions the judge pointed to really concern who had final decision-making authority on day-to-day medical decisions in the jail?
It did not address day-to-day decisions, but the county had oversight over how that medical care was being given. I mean, the issue with respect to the county is whether there's a policy or practice. And I cannot say that the specific provisions in the contract would have oversight over every specific decision made with every inmate. But the contract, the provisions that we referenced, did allow the county to have oversight and some control over how that medical care was being given. For example, it had some control over what employees would be working for HPL. It also required that certain meetings take place to discuss issues and concerns. And if the county did not like how the care was being provided by HPL, it had the option of terminating the contract. The court considered that information.
And that, in your opinion, though, that ability to remove personnel, to hold quarterly meetings, to terminate the contract, that doesn't sound like day-to-day medical decisions, or that you're saying it doesn't fall within that.
I don't think that specifically applies to every day-to-day decision. I don't think the county had oversight over every medical decision made on a daily basis. But the issue with the county is the overall policy.
Didn't we decide on the first appeal in this case that the county had delegated that policy to HPL?
The issue in the first appeal was whether the plaintiff presented sufficient evidence to defeat summary judgment. The district court dismissed the case on summary judgment, as this court is aware, and it was appealed. So the issue was whether the newspaper articles and other evidence presented was sufficient to defeat summary judgment. And this court, while it did look at the contract and the provisions, made a determination that there was a disputed fact and the case should be sent back for trial. The court went on to explain that while it looked at the contract, even if the county did not delegate authority to HPL, there still was a disputed fact with respect to notice. So there was never a determination by this court that the contract, in fact, delegated all decision-making authority to HPL. That was something that the court looked at, but was never determined.
So then this language in the opinion that says the county's express policies as embodied in the contract show that the county delegated to HPL final authority to make decisions about inmates' medical care. So what are we to do with that language?
Well, yes. It does seem to say that.
Right.
But if you look further in the opinion, the court said even if the county had not delegated final decision-making authority, it was on notice that HPL's physician and medication-relating policies were causing problems. So, yes, it's worded that way, but in various places within the decision, the court was, I think, pretty clear in looking at whether there was sufficient evidence to rise to the level of a disputed material fact. And otherwise, there would be no reason to go on to the issue of notice. I mean, if they delegated authority.
We often do that. We often do that when we're analyzing an issue, and so that we can be thorough in an opinion, we'll go on to say, you know, even if there's essentially problems with that finding, it, you know, we will address the other issue that's related. So, to me, that's all that's saying.
And I think the issue of the contract was never an issue that was litigated. You know, the issue on appeal was not whether the contract delegated final decision-making authority, but the issue was whether there was a disputed material fact sufficient to take the case to trial.
Your reading of the case is that the court was not making a final determination on whether the county had delegated.
That's correct. And when the court evaluated the issue, I think it was in a motion in limine, the court looked at that contract and also evaluated the information presented by the county with respect to meetings that they had, with respect to the oversight they had that was outside of the contract. I see my time is up. Are there any questions? Thank you.
How much time? Mr. Olson.
Hi.
Good morning.
I like the point that the shoe is on both feet. What if we were to file a complaint with no legal theories in it at all, and they'd file their motion for summary judgment and fail to address the Fourth Amendment? Well, we just have to respond to the arguments they put in their motion. I think the shoe is on both feet with respect to blame for not getting the Fourth Amendment theory on the table earlier, but it should have been fixed. It could have been fixed, and it wasn't.
Well, that's not a very good analogy, because if you didn't have any law cited in the complaint, it would have been dismissed. No theory of liability. If you didn't have a legal theory articulated in a complaint,
just had to plead facts, but maybe I'm wrong.
You have to plead facts, but those facts have to...
They have to fit a legal theory, but
exactly.
I don't think you have to put the legal...
Exactly. I mean, if they don't fit a legal theory, it's a big problem.
I agree. I don't think you have to specify the legal theory in the complaint. But anyway, to move on, there's two ways to defend a deliberate indifference claim. One is to say our care was reasonable. The other one is to say our care was atrocious, but we were innocent, benign idiots. If you're going to choose the second way of defending the claim, then you don't call any experts to say your care was reasonable. You just get ready when the plaff's experts to say this get up and say this care was atrocious. You get ready to say, I went to Podunk Nursing School, and I haven't had any continuing legal education. I've been stuck out here in this jail by myself. I don't know what's reasonable, what's not. I didn't know I was making a mistake here. If that would have been the defense in this case, then there'd be an argument that there's some real prejudice here when you change from the deliberate indifference standard and take away that subjective defense and move to an objective reasonableness standard. But they chose the first way of defending. They chose the way of defending that said we conducted ourselves reasonably.
How long was the trial?
It was, what, a week and 2 days? Five days.
Five trial days.
So the defense didn't have to turn their ship. And that's why they didn't really want a continuance when the issue of changing the theory and the jury instructions to the proper theory came before the court.
Now, counsel suggested that there was no real discussion about continuing the trial.
My recollection is the judge made it very clear that that was the one thing that was absolutely off the table.
So then you did not ask for a continuance.
We weren't the ones that wanted a continuance to fix our expert testimony. We were ready to go to trial. If the defense was saying we need to fix our expert testimony to adopt to this new theory, we want a continuance, we wouldn't have opposed that by so much as a whisper or a wink.
Yeah, the thing that I have trouble with, and I understand it's difficult when the court has expressed firmly a view, it does not mean that paper cannot be filed. Maybe at the moment, because even if the judge is showing ire or upsetness or whatever with what is happening, that's why you have the opportunity to file paper, you know, outside the presence of the court. And I understand, you know, you might feel there might be pushback, but, I mean, I don't understand why a continuance wasn't requested. Or at least a resistance to going to trial.
I have
under the wrong legal theory.
I have a theory why a continuance wasn't requested, and that's because the defense didn't want to cure any prejudice to them. There wasn't any prejudice. They wanted to force us to trial under a higher wrong legal theory.
Yeah, we haven't talked about mandamus. I know it's an extraordinary remedy, but I mean, anyway, I've expressed my view.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.